You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Now, in these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Now, today's podcast is about the Agriculture Act and the Sustainable Farming Policy, and we're going to discuss challenges and opportunities around them. The Agriculture Act was passed in early November and followed soon after by the Sustainable Farming Policy, which is intended to ensure, amongst other things, that by 2028, farmers can operate safely and profitably without subsidy support. Now, are they going to work? And are farmers happy about them? How are they going to work in the long term? Now, join us to discuss this are Vicky Hurd, Head of Sustainable Farming at the Food and Farming Policy Unit of Sustain.
Hello.
Emily Norton, Head of Rural Research at Savills UK.
Hi there.
Mark Coolman, Chair of the Tenants Farming Association.
Hello.
And Professor Jane Rickson, Professor of Soil Erosion and Conservation at Cranfield Soil and Agri-Food Institute.
Hello.
Now, Vicky, let's just dive in straight away first. For people who don't know what's going on, let's take the Agriculture Act. It's been described as a landmark moment for post-Brexit farming. What does it set out to do? What are the key points inside it?
Well, it is a landmark moment, and it is enabling the government to transfer the measures that we had as part of the European Common Agricultural Policy, the regulation that allowed governments to support farmers across Europe and control things like marketing standards and make sure that you had a sort of common framework for agriculture in Europe. We're now transferring that into the UK through the Agriculture Act, but it does a lot more than that because it's changing the very nature of the support scheme. In not totally, because there'll still be schemes to support farmers for productivity and supporting them in, you know, with R&D, but research and development. But it will also be now supporting farmers for delivering public goods, so public money for public goods, whereas before it was supporting farmers largely for being farmers and doing some green farming schemes. But it's very much a new direction of travel for the relationship between the taxpayer and the farmer.
And what do we mean by public goods?
Public goods are things that can't be delivered by the market or aren't delivered by the market, and are generally not sort of transferable or removable. So it's things like nature, protection of nature, clean water, clean air, and climate change mitigation, and access, public access to the countryside, things that are sort of not so measurable, but definitely are hard to deliver through a marketplace. So it's making sure that the public can get that what they want from a really good sustainable farming system in the UK, in addition to the food that they get through the market.
So public goods is it's terrible grammar for a very fantastic and very positive aspect.
It's a very economic term, and I tend to use the word public benefits, actually.
That's much better. Let's go for that. Yeah, absolutely. Emily, why do we need this act?
Simple answer, Brexit. Previously, the Common Agricultural Policy has been defined at European Union level as a system of consensus between all of the member states. The fact that we are now on our way out of the European Union means that we need a separate piece of legislation, an entire suite of legislation to govern how money is transferred from the taxpayer to support the various different outcomes that are needed from land managers. But it's not just sort of agricultural policy in that direct sense. The things that are talked about within the Agriculture Act are around, public money for public goods. It's also about market operation. It's also about trade and agri-food trade. And it's also very much about compliance baselines and the environmental baselines that go with agricultural land use. So it's an entire suite of legislation that's necessitated by us leaving the European Union.
And it was published about a month ago, which is cutting it a bit fine, really, isn't it?
Kind of yes and no. The legacy system from where we have been is a very sensible place to start. And so what government, both in Scotland and England and the devolved nations have done, sorry, the other devolved nations have done, is to say at least for a certain period of time after the official Brexit date is to continue those legacy schemes and run them in a simpler way, but then begin a process of transition to what the devolved nations then believe to be a better system of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Mark, you are, I believe, farming 235 hectares of arable land. You've got a bunch of different crops there. Is this good news for farmers?
I think it's an interesting development for farmers, and it creates...
That's a man speaking through gritted teeth, isn't it?
No, not entirely. I think there are some really interesting opportunities being presented to us by the change, but there are undoubtedly going to be some challenges ahead in terms of how the change is able to be practically implemented at a farm level.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, there's a clear need for environmental benefits to come from this, because we've done a lot of stewardship schemes historically which are driven by the European Union. Going to continue to do that, but the scale at which the government are interested in doing it is quite significant, and the move and the challenge, I guess, is to get a balance between the needs of the environment and nature and the needs of food production, and to tie those two things together in a sustainable way, both economically and environmentally, is going to be a challenge, I think.
Mm. Is there anything specific that you can tell me that is significantly different from what we had before?
Yeah, well, the obvious thing is we've been used to, under the European Union system, being basic payment. So in simple terms, if I have a hectare of land, I receive a sum of money for that hectare, regardless of what I do to it, what I grow on it. And that is there to support my business, I guess. There's arguments around what it's there to support, but fundamentally it helps to support my business. The real change now is that I will have to evidence that what I've done is value for money. And so therefore, if I've got for example, I might choose to have a flower margin, which will encourage pollinators and insects and bird life. Now I will have to demonstrate that what I've actually done there has delivered the outcome that is specified. So it is a different way of being supported. And I mean, I, for one, I absolutely think it's the right way to go. And I think you will get a large level of support from the farming community for that, because I think we are used to working to markets, to delivering things that are required, and the BPS system was a very blunt instrument to deliver support to agriculture. The challenge is how you measure all of that, how you evidence that farmers have delivered those goods, and in the past that has been around what now seem to be quite straightforward environmental things, and especially with the demand from climate change coming into this as well. I think Vicky mentioned soil, air, water. There's a lot of different elements to the schemes, and to bring all of that into one system of support it's a great opportunity, but it's going to be challenging, and the time scale we've got to do it over is another challenge in itself.
Mm. And it's a 7-year transition period, is that right? Or am I?
It's a 7-year transition period, but we now know that the current basic payment system will be halved between now and 2024. And the ELMS, which is the sort of basic environmental land management scheme, which will form the basis of the change of support, is coming into in 2024 and is being developed over the next 2 or 3 years. But there's a huge amount of work to do in amongst that. But I think we're up for the challenge. I'm certainly not somebody that thinks we should just plod along as we always have done. And I think coming out of the European Union and having the ability to create these schemes to the UK environment offers a really exciting opportunity. But we do have to get the balance right between sustainable food production and environmental benefit and, climate change requirements.
Yeah. So that's the perfect lead on for this question then, Jane. Have we got the balance right? Is it the right time for this legislation? And is it good enough for the environment?
I think it is very timely. I'm delighted as a soil scientist that soils are mentioned specifically very early on in the Act. And I think certainly we haven't looked after our soils as well as we might. Obviously, there's lots of examples of very good practice out there, but also I think we need to support farmers to manage their soils in a way that do deliver all these different public benefits, as well as producing the food that we eat, as well as fibre and fodder and all the other things that we get from soil. So I think it is very timely, and I'm really pleased that it explicitly mentions soil health and soil quality, because that underpins all of our agricultural activities, whether it's arable, horticulture, livestock, wherever we get our food from. It's all about soil health and soil quality. The challenge, I think, is how do you measure soil health? How do you appreciate that it's improving or that we're degrading it? And I think that is the challenge that scientists face now. What is soil health and how do we measure it and how do we monitor it to then reward farmers that are improving their soil health over space and time?
It's almost like we need a Soil and Agri-Food Institute to look at this, isn't it, Jane?
Oh, what a great idea. That would be fantastic. let me think about that.
presumably the workload for you, you're just beginning to imagine what it's going to be like over the coming years, because presumably you'll be closely involved in how this unfolds.
Yes, and we're working with DEFRA and various organisations to actually understand and identify how this could be implemented. As with all good policies, they're only as good as the implementation. So it's very important. And certainly if you see, the philosophy of the 25-year environment plan, it's fantastic in terms of the ambition and the vision of what agriculture and indeed our whole environment is going to look like in 25 years' time. But it's the delivery of that and the implementation of it and the fairness that we reward farmers and land managers that are getting it right and helping and supporting those that are under pressure, that means that they might not be carrying out the best practice on their land for all very good reasons. And often that's an economic driver that is forcing farmers to act in a certain way. But if we then combine that with environmental benefit and social benefits, those are the three pillars of sustainability that we should be aiming for.
Yeah. Okay. So Vicky, this is an interesting aspect, isn't it? It's ambitious, but it's about the delivery of it. Do you feel that there are holes and weaknesses in the Act? I mean, it's been worked on since 2018 and only finally been introduced. Do you feel that it covers enough, or are you concerned?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it has changed. The Agriculture Act Mark 1, for instance, didn't include any reference to soil, and we lobbied very hard for it to include that. And so we were very pleased. And agroecology is mentioned, albeit in a very minor way. And we want to see agroecological whole farm systems really supported. And there's a lot of work to do that. But one of the other exciting things about the Act is that it does include a clause about introducing transparency and fair dealing into the supply chain. Not talking about the big retailers, because they're covered by a grocery code adjudicator and they're supposed to adhere to specific codes, but now we'll potentially have codes for the supply chain. So they should be playing fairer with farmers, which, as everybody said already, farmers need to get a decent return from the market and a decent treatment from the market in terms of their contracts, when they have to deliver what and in what form. That really matters to farmers as much as the public support for the public goods that they'll be delivering. So those twin things in the Act are potentially quite exciting. But the big gap And there is a big, there's several gaps. One of the biggest gaps is a lot of it is what we would call enabling. So it's a power to deliver these things. It doesn't actually require the Secretary of State to do it or to fund it or the Treasury to fund it. You know, there's loads of potential all in the implementation, as people have said. So it's got to be really, we've got to work really hard to make sure the right things are delivered, the right budget is delivered. And also there's the big issue of trade deals and agri-food imports that might come as a result of trade deals that we're doing after we leave the European Union. And those agri-food imports might flood in and undermine what farmers are trying to do, make it very difficult for them to actually deliver food with the standards that we're asking them to when they're competing with lower standard imports. So that was one thing we wanted to change in the Act, and it didn't really happen. We got some concessions. So there's gaps in the Act and gaps in terms of democracy, but at the same time, exciting potential for it to deliver some really good green sustainable farming.
Excellent. Okay, so that's one side of it. That's the Agriculture Act. Now, Emily, we also have the Sustainable Farming Policy. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? I mean, that's a little bit more recent. What does it mean, and what is its? Does it have a symbiotic relationship with the Agriculture Act?
So the Agriculture Act, as Vicky's just alluded to, sort of creates categories of things that government can give financial assistance for. And the thing that everybody's been talking about in relation to post-Brexit agricultural policy, which isn't even mentioned in the Agriculture Act, is the Environmental Land Management Scheme, which is the government's flagship scheme for transferring public money to farmers for the delivery of environmental outcomes. So this idea of public money for public goods, those are going to be transferred and identified within that particular scheme. So ELMS, we're all talking about ELMS. And the Sustainable Farming Incentive is the first level of ELMS, which is intended to be the stepping stone for farmers who've not previously been engaged thinking about sustainable farming to get onto that agenda. And in theory, it should cover things like a soil management plan and a whole farm approach to how farm businesses can be run in a more sustainable way.
So, Mark, is ELMS an issue that a lot of farmers have not had to deal with yet? And do you think that these two new, the Act and the policy between them, will make farmers start dealing with sustainable issues when they haven't before?
I'm not sure it's fair to say that farmers haven't engaged with sustainable policies up to now. If we go back to maybe 10 years ago, I think, when we had the start of what was a sort of ELS scheme, we had sort of over 70% of farmers were engaged in some kind of environmental work, albeit, some of it was fairly basic. So I think there has been engagement with these schemes in the past. I think the difference we have now, which was brought up just now, is that the ambition of ELMS is so much greater, and the areas that are covered by ELMS is also so much greater. So when you're talking about soils, for example, it's really good. I would second what Jane said there, that to have that included is really important, as is water, air, access to the countryside. And so I think the farmers have been engaged with sustainable policies, but I think the broad nature of what we've been asked to do now is probably the big change.
So, okay, let's get down to the basics of this, really, for anyone who doesn't really know. Jane, could you explain to us the basics of what we mean by green farming and certainly sustainable farming?
So the way I'd approach this, and I suspect there are as many definitions as there are people talking about sustainability, but I think what we should be aiming for, as I've mentioned earlier, is the three pillars. This has got to be economic. It's got to be economic and keep farmers in business, basically. The old argument, it's very difficult to be green when you're in the red, I think is a very good starting point. So we have to keep rural livelihoods and farming businesses going. So economics is the first pillar. That's very, very important. And I think a lot of the comments about, trading deals and what the economic future is going to look like as far as price of commodities and so on is going to be relevant to that. But the second pillar of sustainability is that it's got to be farmed in an environmental way. And that obviously, that's very important. That's what we're talking about, greening and regenerative farming and so on, where we're not taking out more than we're putting back in. That would be the ideal, balancing that with the economic drivers that the farmers face as well. And then, of course, the third pillar is social, that whatever is done, whatever change in practice comes about because of the sustainable farming plan and ELMS and so on, or ELMS as apparently they're called now. We mustn't call them ELMS because that apparently assumes that everybody thinks it's all about trees and not about all the other actions that come under the ELMS. I still say ELMS, it's easier to say, to be honest with you. But anyway, the social pillar in terms of, you know, we all value the green and pleasant land that we live in, which is a result of how farmers manage that landscape. And, you know, a lot of traditions and a lot of livelihoods are based on that green and pleasant land. And so that's the social aspect of farming. But, I do go back to this point that it's hard to be green when you're in the red. So we've got to get the economics right and support farmers. And as a scientist, I would say this, wouldn't I? But, you know, the evidence, I think there's a lot of nervousness and caution about schemes like ELMS and how farmers are going to be rewarded for the public benefits they give. I think there's a lot of evidence that we need to generate to demonstrate that if you do this practice, you will get that result, you will get that outcome. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of things like minimum tillage, cover cropping, you know, these practices that we know are good for soil. But is that enough? Just saying it's good for soil, I don't think that will be robust enough to then base farm payments on the basis of just that, well, a soil scientist said that's good for soil. And getting those more robust measures and metrics of evidence, I think, is going to be quite a challenge.
And actually policing this is an issue as well. I mean, I guess we're not going to have people wandering around every field saying, yes, that bit works, that bit doesn't. I mean, how it's presumably self-reported, isn't it? How does that work?
Well, I'm to be honest with you, I'm not sure how that is, that what mechanism is going to be used for that, whether it is going to be on an inspection basis or whether it's going to be, yes, self-reporting. And again, we're not entirely sure whether it's about, I mean, for soils, for example, is it going to be about the soil properties? Are we going to be asking farmers and land managers and growers to measure the organic matter content in their soil, for example, which would require them to send it off to labs and so on? Or are we going to ask them as to what practices they actually use? You know, have you reduced the amount of intensive cultivations that you've carried out on your land? And that I don't think that has been solved or discussed. Well, it has been discussed, but it hasn't been agreed as to what those metrics are actually going to be, not only for soils, but water and air and so on, and all the environmental properties that we're trying to improve.
Now, Vicky, this is a really naive question, so slap me down if you want to. Why do we need these interventions? I mean, I know that, you know, supermarkets and the big retailers have a huge amount of buying power. They seem to control prices, don't pay enough for things, and the public has to help fund farming through taxes that then become subsidies. Will we ever get to a place where the trade is just simple? We pay for our food and the money trickles down the supply chain without interventions, or is that just not possible because humans aren't like that?
It's a great question, though. Why shouldn't it work like that? But it really doesn't, and it hasn't for a long time. There's been a twin process of many decades of centralizing the supply chains and making them all powerful compared to the farmers, which are effectively mostly very small businesses selling to a very small number of buying desks to sell to millions of customers. So there's a tiny little bit, and if you imagine an hourglass bit in the middle that controls everything. But then also we've had, as Mark said, a common agricultural policy which has been directing farmers not particularly usefully. It's done some good things and helped a lot of farmers do some good practices, and we've had some outcomes. But the twin processes have meant we've gone so far away from the price you get in the shop, that you pay in the shop, making sure a farmer can treat its land and its animals and its workers in a way that you would consider reasonable. We've gone so far away from that that we do have to still intervene, and we probably will for a long time. And I think intervene both in terms of regulating supply chains and the retailers, but also intervene in supporting farmers in the transition. I think what's good about all this is Emily described the sustainable farming incentive. That's going to be available quite soon to all farmers. There's going to be pilots next year and the year after, but a lot of farmers will start to be able to access a scheme which won't be, you know, extremely difficult. I have seen the details of what they're going to be asking. A lot of them are based, as Jane asked, they're actually a lot of them based on actions. So if you've done an action, you'll be able to say an action and self-reporting, but there will be some sort of spot checks and things like that, and some enforcement. But the farmers will be able to get that and start to transfer to a farming system which really supports both the environmental goods, the nature, and tackle climate change and mitigation. So there's many, many things they're going to be asked to do, lots of complexities, as Mark said. So it needs to be a transition, and there needs, one of the critical things is to have a proper advisory and guidance process to deliver on that. And that's, I think, is still a huge gap. Farmers are going to need support from each other and from a preferably free advisory process.
Now, Emily, I mean, we talked earlier today about the UK's relationship with the EU after the 1st of January. Now, because we're changing the system here in the UK and changing the concept of benefits and outputs and their relationship for also between the farmers and the consumers, does this affect our relationship with the rest of the EU? Do you think that the cap will change because we have changed what we've done here? Is this a positive outcome of Brexit, or is this just a change that's going to happen across Europe in any case eventually?
Okay, so, I mean, it's a super interesting question, which comes to kind of the nature of the European Union and the things that it has competency over. And it's been really interesting to hear Jane, for example, talk about soil and the fact that we haven't previously had the ability or the policies in place to protect soil. And that is one key thing that the European Union does not have competency over. So it has competency over elements of the environment. It has competency over water, because water is a shared resource between member states. Obviously, rivers flow between countries. And so, you know, one river is in multiple countries' interests. And so the legislation that we've had in this space, in the land use compliance space, has largely been derived from water, and it's not focused on soil at all. And so in theory, the Common Agricultural Policy will continue to try and do what it does, which is to exert as much control over farmer behaviour as possible. And that is the mechanism by which it seeks to achieve as much environmental benefit as possible. But the conditionality is very weak compared to what you could do if you had national level policies, which effectively worked as a fixed baseline, a fixed compliance baseline on some of those issues. The key difference, I think, going forwards is how we begin to interplay what we see as straightforward agricultural activities around food production with some of the big macro level drivers around net zero policy in particular. The EU tends to tie itself in knots around what it has competency over and what member states have competency over, and how particular the net zero carbon sphere works. I would like to think that we could do that in a much more holistic and intelligent way at UK level. However, the way that trade works at UK level, the way that environment and agriculture and carbon issues work at devolved nation level, means we really need to have some very clear communication structures and strategies around how these policies are developed on an ongoing basis. So it's not straightforward, but there is opportunity.
And the concept of, I've been fascinated over the last 2 years of whether or not there's a potential for each product to have a set of sort of carbon impact points? You know, do you get 10 points for a positive environmental impact of how the wheat has been grown, or and has there been a level of biodiversity? Do you think this is a potentially a trading issue in the coming years with the EU by saying, you know, these products have an environmental impact that is better than X, therefore it has a different value?
Again, Stefan, it's a really, really fascinating question, and unfortunately without a straightforward answer, because if you look at things from an environment, you know, and it comes to the question you asked about sustainability earlier as well, like what do we actually mean when we say that? You know, what are we actually looking at when we say we want it to have a better environmental impact? Because actually, in terms of efficiencies, in terms of, say, carbon efficiencies and minimizing the carbon impact, actually that creates a bias towards very intensive production systems where you are, you know, achieving a slaughter age, you know, at a relatively young age, high stocking densities. You can justify a lot of things that the consumer may not necessarily want if your only metric of concern is carbon. If you are then looking at water impacts or air quality impacts or biodiversity impacts, you could argue again that removing food production from environmental spaces creates a better biodiversity impact because you are not trying to share the space. Now, those things are all the opposite of an agroecological approach where it's very integrated between food production systems and environmental systems and biodiversity systems. But sort of minimizing the impact and looking for efficiencies there can create a bias that is not necessarily what we are seeking to achieve in doing so. So it's not straightforward in saying that a labeling system that is measuring that kind of impact right way to go. We need to be clear.
And also you start getting into the realms of moral relativity when we're talking about animal welfare and issues like that, as well as environmental relativity. You're right, it becomes very complex.
Tim Lang once described it an omni-label. Don't you have to have so many things on the label? It would get very long.
It would get. I'd like that, but I don't think most people would. Now, Mark, are these policies going to stop the big farm amalgamations, which I know Vicky is very concerned about as well, and do you think that the Act and the policy will stop all these farmers just simply giving up and moving on into a different industry?
That's a very good question. I mean, I would say they absolutely have the potential to ensure that farms of various sizes can thrive. The challenge again is to make sure that the support system that is put in place is as accessible to small family units, if you like, as the big agribusinesses. And they may require different levels of support and support for different things. So I think the answer to your question is yes, there is a potential for it to stop that happening, but there is also a danger that it will have the opposite effect, I think. And maybe I could I just come back, Stefan, on a little bit of what was said earlier around economic sustainability in particular, because fundamentally underpinning the economic sustainability of any business, not just a farm business, but any business, is probably the market and the consumer's preparedness to pay the rate which more than covers the cost of production and therefore is able to provide an economically sustainable business. I think that is one of the challenges that we have in the whole food system. And we've talked a lot, obviously, about environmental impact and benefiting soils and different methods of cultivation and one thing and another, and labelling, whether something should be labelled in a particular way. I think, sadly, in some ways, we have to remember that a huge majority of the consumers of our products are their biggest single driver, which is proved time and time again, is price. And we have to be able to get to a market where the return that we receive for the food that we produce makes us economically sustainable. And then we can do lots of the other green stuff. And that's really difficult to do. I'm not suggesting that's easy, but it's difficult to do. And I think consumers are largely price driven when it comes to food. Of course, there are exceptions. Of course, there are an increasingly bigger percentage of the population who are interested in where their foods come from, but it's still, you know, 10, 12, 15% of stuff that's purchased, not the vast majority.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And if only that was different, then I think a lot of other things would cascade behind it. We've talked for a long time already, and I know that there's so much more that we can talk about, but I think we're going to have to come back to this again at another stage. I'd like to finish with a question to each of you in turn, and that is, what are the changes that we're likely to see initially? Certainly from my point of view as a consumer, what will we see first, but then also conceptually or environmentally going on behind the scenes, and what are there any surprises in there as well? Jane, I wonder if you could start us off.
That's a huge question. Thanks for that, and thank you for starting me. Thank you.
You can choose. Just choose your favourite one.
I have
How about
so many
that?
To choose from. Well, of course, I'm going to say that I think there's appreciation of the value of soils. I would say that, wouldn't I? But I think the way that we manage soils, and I'm just picking up on an earlier point, I do understand that, you know, there are many short-term drivers here which are stopping us seeing from the longer term view. And I think soil management, environmental management is very apt as far as that's concerned, because, you know, decisions are made in the short term that may be degrading our soil resources and our environmental resources. And if we could only support farmers and farming and agriculture to be able to take the long view, to see the longer term benefits of building up organic matter, for example, of improving soil structure and soil quality and soil health. But that's not going to happen overnight. And reconciling this short-term economic driver with the environmental and social long-term benefits that we get through better environmental management, I think that for me is the challenge. And I hope that these policies and this Act will enable us as a society to support farmers to be able to take that long-term view. So it's not really a vision, but it's.
Sorry. And I wonder if people are going. I wonder if people are going to start to understand that the quality of the soil is an issue that so rarely impacts consumer in a way that they understand. It's so vital. It's so important to the production of our food, but somebody opening up a bag of ready chips to stick in the oven at home has no concept
of that.
Do you think that will change?
And I think it's not just, you know, it's just not the quantity of food that farmers produce, but it's also the quality, you know, things like nutrients and oxidants. I mean, we could play into the sort of human health aspect in terms of, you know, where are we getting our healthy foods from, our nutrients and our vitamins? They also come from the soil, as well as the quantity of food that needs to be produced. So I agree, it's a big PR job that needs to be done so that people see soil for the amazing, valuable resource it is, rather than that brown, muddy stuff that makes my clothes dirty. And I think, you know, I think we need a more transparent food chain. That would certainly help. And I think our food chains have become so complicated and complex and long, and therefore very vulnerable, I have to say. I think if we encourage shorter supply chains, then they'll be less vulnerable and people will start to appreciate where their food has come from. And I think that is a job that needs to be done. And I think organizations like LEAF, for example, are really good at that, with open farm Sundays, encouraging people to go out onto farms, see where their food has actually come from. And initiatives like that, I think, should be supported so that there is better education and knowledge of where food originates.
Yeah, food in the curriculum is a big issue, I think, as well. Vicky, okay, to you now. What changes do you think we're likely to see in the shorter term? And then also, what sort of big systemic changes are you hoping that this will all achieve?
Well, it was great to hear Jane talking then about shorter food change, which I think have had a real boost during this pandemic,
because
a lot of people have turned to them to get some of their supplies and have started to get excited about what they can get through shorter. And we are definitely hoping to capitalise on that. We've been working on shorter food chains for many years. And I gave a talk recently where I said I would like to see a 25% increase in the alternative, better routes to market for farmers. And that could be starting next year, it could, and continuing from then. So farmers get more than 8%, which is what they get from the current pound spend on, in, you know, average pound spend, yeah. 8% they get. So that should change. I would also like to think people might start to see more trees and agroforestry, because that's now being recognised as a real potential for getting multiple benefits from a farm system when you put trees with animals and with crops, and you get crops from the trees, etc., etc.
So more plantations. Trees.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they'll come anyway, because there's such a push for climate and for carbon sequestration in trees. I would like to see more of them as sort of real native trees, broadleaf and agroforestry. But also, we should be seeing more diverse farming systems, because farmers will be able to diversify, possibly grow more fruit and veg, because we've got a huge gap in our capacity to grow fruit and veg, and we shouldn't be growing them. Everybody's talking now about vertical farms and soilless systems. So again, I'm with Jane on that. There is a real nutrient problem if you're growing all your fruit and veg in rock wool. Let's grow it in soil, but grow it well in soil. If you're using agroecological methods to protect everything. And so some more diversification, and so those foods can find a market locally. And I'm not just talking about niche, expensive stuff. I'm talking about for everybody, because all the polls that we know and see and do show that people on any income grade want better food and fairer and ethical food. They just can't afford it or can't access it. It's not that they don't want it, they do. So we should make that available, and I'd love to see a big growth in that over the next few years. And that would be the systemic change that I think will make a difference for all sizes of farms, because there is a risk that we do lose lots of farms, and that would be for climate, for diversity, for features, landscapes, for jobs, all sorts of things would be a bad outcome. So making those markets work for all types of farms would be great.
And Emily, what changes do you think the public are likely to see? And then what systemic changes are you hoping to see?
I think the most visible change next year will be anything that comes out of the food strategy, Henrod Dimbleby's second part of the food strategy, and how that then builds into broader policies. I think the consequences of the Agriculture Act are going to be fairly limited from a public point of view. But some of those big links between food and health that Vicky has just been alluding to, I think, are going to be front and centre of policy debates next year, particularly post-coronavirus. And in terms of the big systemic stuff, Mark Carney is sustainable agriculture's best friend. And I think as soon as we realise that awful lot of things that you're talking about in terms of balancing consumer power, the destructive consequences of unsustainable consumerism, all need to be changed at systemic level. Otherwise, we get nowhere. It is not the power of the consumer that's going to change this. It's the power of the market organization, which is going to rebalance it away from the negative consequences of information imbalances within systems. As soon as we understand that somebody like Mark Carney and what he is doing with the green finance strategy around net zero agendas, and how you can begin to create a systemic financial structure that values sustainability correctly within decision-making, and how money then flows towards preferring sustainable, resilient, regenerative systems over extractive ones, that's going to produce the real systemic level change. And it's nothing to do with the Agriculture Act.
Emily Norton's extraordinary clarity once again. Mark, you're talking from the farmer's point of view. What changes are we likely to see first? And then what's going to happen systemically? What's happening under the covers?
So I'm afraid I'm going to be a little bit more negative than your previous speakers. I think in the short term, you're going to see some very challenged farm businesses in the next 1 to 3 years. And that may lead to some businesses going out of the sector, and it may lead to changing landscapes in terms of how.
And is that because of the challenges of implementing the new regulations and changing economics?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's a challenge of the change in the support system in the short term, and I think a lot of this hangs on the trade deals and the food standards of imported food that is either likely or not going to happen. We don't know the answer to this yet. But if the import standards of some of the product that comes in is lower than we are expected to provide and therefore cheaper, that is going to offer a massive economic challenge in the short term. So I have to say I'm a little bit pessimistic about the next couple of years, but I would counter that with the sort of medium to long term, because I do think there probably is there's a massive opportunity here if we get this change in support and the direction of travel that everybody has talked about this evening, in terms of environmental sustainability and bringing the consumers along with us and sustainable food production. I think there's a huge opportunity in the long term, and I really hope this happens, to see a change in our landscapes, but a change for the better, where we've got areas which are very strong for biodiversity and nature being absolutely used for that. For those areas of the country which are able to really intensify in terms of their food production, not ignoring nature by any means, because that is a part and parcel of what we need to do, but being integrated. And also, I think it's a massive opportunity for farmers to come together and collaborate better. We're very bad at collaborating generally. And one of the ways in which smaller farming businesses, you know, often do thrive is when they collaborate well. And again, I think this policy has the opportunity to make that happen a bit more by opening up local food chains, cutting the food supply chain, and so potentially really changing the landscape for the better, both economically and environmentally. But I do think to get there, we've got some quite challenging years ahead.
Well, that sounds like a very sage bit of advice for us. Well, we hope that, that the Act does succeed in bringing on some kind of new green revolution, and certainly a huge amount of change for the better. And I think we're going to have to come back to this subject again and again, and I hope that you'll all join us to talk about it in the future. Well, Jane, Vicky, Emily and Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Professor Jane Rickson, Vicky Hurd, Emily Norton, Mark Coolman and me, Stephen Gates. Thank you very much. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.